has a very a wonderful discussion on the image of the city in English writing. And one of them that Carol and I read Measure for Measure last year in this context. I don't know how many of you remember that play by Shakespeare, but it's not one that always gets discussed. That's a play that might be fun to read in May too, because I was so surprised at what a real combination of problems develop in that Measure for Measure. The scenes of the play, in that play, are as a whole mostly outside the brothel or inside the prison, and though it is the brothel which has been most insisted on, it is the prison which is here important. The brothel is the appetite, and the prison is the result of virtue striking at the appetite. Pretty good way of putting it. The brothel is the appetite, and the prison is the virtue striking at the appetite. Because, you know, I mean, when somebody does something wrong, then the thing that has to happen is it has to be punished, because otherwise they'll keep on doing it, you know? An extreme virtue in Angelo, but human. It is precisely because it is human that the problem arises. Claudio has been plucked out of the mass to be an example for this particular law that is part of the city, and he is to die by the law. But both Aeschylus and Isabella, two of the people in Measure for Measure, are morally uneasy about his death. They both raise the question whether a judge may in fact sentence a man for an act to which the judge is himself inclined, and which he may indeed himself have committed. How far in this order, which holds and is a necessity of the city in this world, are the executants of that order prevented by their own faults from judging, or compelled by their own faults to show mercy? Now, this is a problem of justice that Williams is talking about. If you have committed the sin, then that you're going to have to judge. Maybe you judge them even harder because you figure, you know, well, they shouldn't have gotten caught. Or, on the other hand, maybe because you've committed the sin yourself as a judge, that may just make you feel very extra merciful and even sentimentally merciful toward this person, because you realize that you have the same faults that he has, and what puts you in a position to be able to judge over him. Now, you have to remember that in this play, when they're discussing justice, they're discussing it from the point of view, two points of view. One is the point of view of actual law, in which, as Laverne Rieke would say, you're always in error, but never in doubt. You have to act, even if you feel like there are two sides to a question. And for the judge, he sees the two sides to the question, and yet he has to judge it somehow. And he can't allow one side or the other. He's got to be led only by the facts in the case. Well, says Isabella, this is not always, you know, this isn't always the right way to do things. Angelo takes the strictest view, and he's the kind of the hero of the play. We must carry out the law, he says to Aeschylus. The guilt of the judge has nothing to do with it. If that is ever discovered, let him also die. When, however, he says something of the same sort to Isabella, she makes a reply which is one of the most familiar speeches in Shakespeare, and has, by being dragged out of its context so often, half lost its terrible force. And that's true. You know, very often it's true of the scripture too. We drag a lot of neat Bible verses out of context in Scripture, and they lose the force. They lose the terribleness of their meaning because we make it sort of, you know, fit into a literary, nice literary quotation. If we lose this justice, Angelo says, the form of the state will break down. Isabella, exclaiming on, quote, man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority. Man, proud man, dressed in a little brief authority, makes justice almost unjust. At least she makes it ridiculous. The way she talks about it. It becomes one of the fantastic tricks played before high heaven. She does not deny its validity. She merely makes nonsense of it. And then then Williams says this. Justice must be. And what is justice? This. The angels weeping. The angels weeping. Now, Angelo, I don't know whether Shakespeare had a feeling that taking the name of Angelo being like the angels, but until Angelo can weep, there can be no real justice. That is, that finally, and what actually does happen, is the real solution seems perhaps to lie at the end of the play when punishment is desired by the offender and mercy by the offended. And there's a real switch in the play. Spirits are not finely touched, but two fine issues. And this, in its degree, is the finest issue. The issue to which the play is touched is the reconciliation within the city of the justice, which both must and must not be. Chastity, invoking a mercy beyond that justice, has become itself a temptation and a danger to the all but chaste, the all but just soul. May the possibly guilty condemn the guilty? Now, all secular government asserts it. You realize that that's true? I'm going to read that again. May the possibly guilty condemn the guilty? May they? What do you think? Is it, what, does it work out in actual fact? The possibly guilty condemn the guilty? What, look at most of the trials, law courts. Are all the judges who acted in divorce laws, in divorce cases, are all those judges faithful to their wives? Do they all have good marriages? Are none of them divorced? Does no judge ever have a murderous thought? Are the judges, you know, images and ideals of perfection? Did the people who write the laws of the state, were they people who were, you know, perfect people? And yet they do imply, we all imply in the laws of the state that guilt and wrongdoing in the state must be punished. Is that right or isn't it? It has to be. You can't operate a state with some kind of analysis of everybody's inner life before they just determine what they're going to do. And that's what Williams says. He says all secular government asserts this. There isn't any other way to operate. Ought we to excuse it because the sin is natural and we may commit it or have in intention at least committed it? Should we excuse it? Should all wrongdoing be excused because we know, you and I know, that we have hearts that are exactly like the criminals, only we just haven't, we've had a little better training, and we've covered it up, or we haven't had the problems, or the backgrounds, or the hang-ups, or what psychological structure you want to put it to. the temporal city would fall. And it's just what John said. The quote is, it must not be. It has to be this way. You can't operate ordinary governance without a rough justice. And it's rough, because none of it is exact. And as Laverne always says, you wouldn't have a court case, you don't have a trial, if the lines are clear. If everybody knows what's right and wrong, why bring it to the court? It's because there's a doubt. Because there's a mixture of motives, there are a lot of things that have to be brought up, and it has to be decided by somebody else who's outside the involved group. But in that single speech, Isabella manages to suggest that the other way is equally fatal as it is fantastic. The fall of Angelo, a much better man than most, is the example of it. Who dare judge? Only he. And he breaks as he judges. The possible moment of passion and pardon in the last act is perhaps the solution, as it is certainly the play's solution. But humanly speaking, is not this solution unreliable? It will not, in the ordinary sense, work. Indeed, even in the play, it only works at that last moment of an intolerable necessity made awful to us in the appeals of Mariana to Isabella. And it's very, you know, it's a very good thing to read a play like this that is not written by somebody who is trying to propagate a Christian message of any particular, you know, that's not why Shakespeare wrote it. He wrote it because it was a good, you know, it's a good plot, good play, good mixture of problems and motives and people and, you know, good people to come to it. Well, it turns out to be a very good play. It isn't always the most popular one for acting, but it's a good one for reading. Another play by Shakespeare that I read after, I hadn't read it before, and I read it after I read this essay, is the historical play Coriolanus. And someone, I should have read it, because during the Watergate thing, somebody said that Coriolanus would be a good play to read in connection with the Watergate, the whole Watergate event. But I read it more in terms of what Williams talks about, which is the theme of the failure of the city. That's the way he sees Coriolanus. And this is what he says in connection with this. The one necessary thing, the living together in the city, is found unbearable in peace. It can be done in war. It's unbearable in peace. It can be done in war. The one necessary thing, the living together in the city, is found unbearable in peace. It can be done in war. Coriolanus can live and fight with his soldiers, but not with those soldiers when they are citizens.
They call World War II Britain's finest hour.
Exactly. Of course it's true. And it's like in Oslo when they were, you know, under attack by the Nazis, for the first time and probably the only time, they were a unified country. Christians and non-Christians actually talked to each other. It's really amazing. And I remember one of the pastors said that he preached on the Sunday night of Easter, and he said the disciples gathered together for fear. Their unity was in the fear and the fright and the threat, and then eventually in going out and attacking that. But that kind of unification comes only when there is risk and venture, and not in a sort of sedentary kind of a settling back on your laurels sort of thing. And Coriolanus has real problems with this. Because in war they live together because they are in a state of necessity. Just as Churchill, as John mentioned, Churchill's The Finest Hour. And death being involved at the risk any moment of a literally intolerable necessity. Now, we had this reunion of the prisoner of war of our prisoner of war camp down in San Francisco. And it was 32 years since we'd seen each other, and we it was a great weekend to have a chance to renew these acquaintances and friendships. We really related to each other during those 3 years under the Japanese, and with the sense of the possibility of imminent death or annihilation. We, not that we were we weren't all cozy palsy with each other, but we worked together because we were living on the edge of risk. But you know, we saw each other in peace, and it was wonderful to see each other, and we were so happy. It was a great celebration. But we couldn't, you couldn't reconstruct that same group of people and put them in one suburb of San Francisco and say, now, you know, you knew each other for 3 years and went through so much together. Why don't you, you know, live together now and enjoy being at peace? You know, you can get all the food you need and everything will be fine. You think it would have worked? Think we could have, you know, gotten along with each other? Christians against Christians, and Christians against miners, and miners against miners, and engineers against administrators, you know, bang! We didn't have that which pulled us together anymore. And this is where the city, in a sense, you know, where an artificially constructed city is a difficult thing to live in. In peace, everything changes. The nobles cannot bear to treat the populace properly, and the populace cannot bear to live in their poverty. Coriolanus will not allow of freedom, and the tribunes will not allow of obedience. It is not easily possible to find words for these opposed persons outside the words of the play. They are made up of details. They are all of them right, and yet wrong in their rightness. This is absolutely true. Up to the middle of the play, this schism in the city continues. Each is caught in a trap, and each one supposes that his own trap is the city. The only way out would be for someone to accept the apparently impossible. And so, finally, you know, Coriolanus, it's a tragedy, of course, and it ends thus. But it's interesting because of the fact that Coriolanus is a great unifying figure, and they have a great fight on their hands, and they're victorious, and then the fruits of victory settle on them, and they no longer live in that unity because peace is too stultifying for them. They no longer have the risk. And interesting from the point of view of understanding what this city, this image of the city, is involved in. Now you see, this is a secular city that he's using, but you can make the applications to the city of God as you see why the city of God is a different kind of place and why it's not built with walls that are physical, that shut people out. In Coriolanus, the city does not want to be the city. Romans do not want to be Rome. And it's an interesting interesting fact that the one of the last statements that Williams makes about this particular from this particular context, he says, but the city, if it is to continue to exist temporally, not as an eternal city, but as a time city, must defy dullness and stupidity. If it's going to exist temporally, the city must defy dullness and stupidity. And when you want a city to be, you know, have no problems and to be peaceful and beautiful and geometrically correct and hygienically safe and everything perfect, you know, it's not going to work out because it's bound to be dull. If you don't allow for rebels within the city, if you don't allow for criticism, if you don't allow for even insurrections, you know, you're going to run into problems. Yeah?
And Jeremiah said, you know, the idolatry of the standard of living.
Mm-hmm.
Our cities are...
Yeah.
How can
The standard of living, right. And I think this problem that we have of wanting to homogenize the culture, homogenize everything so that we all look and act and speak and feel alike is what makes for dumbness. And and we're likely to run into that. It's a problem because you do want everyone to have the same opportunity. And when you're going to give that kind of opportunity to people, then you run into the danger of a homogenized background and production line. But I think that it is possible to, if we can keep up the spirit of discussion and conversation, of being able to have a controversy without feeling like we're killing each other off, that cities can still be what they were meant to be, a place where people are together, something that the wilderness never has. Wilderness is a great place to go to, but cities are where people are in commerce with each other, in exchanges. And that doesn't mean for one moment that people who live in the, you know, live on the outposts or in frontiers or by themselves in the wilderness are not living a way of exchange either. They're living a way of exchange too, because they're dependent on other people and willing to accept from other people in many, many ways. But the city is where most people gather and live together, and that's where you have the cross-section of this kind of life of exchange. The description that Williams makes of the four walls of the city, I think is something for you to think about when you confess the creed. Because he says the city has four walls. One of them is the communion of saints, one of them is the forgiveness of sins, one of them is the resurrection of the body, and the other is the life everlasting. A neat kind of way to understand the city of God. And that's why they're not physical walls, and they can't even be walls that shut people out. I mean, we know in that city that we had entered into that kind of a surrounding. But they always have to be open so that people are not shut out by one wall or another because they don't believe they're there. You know, they're not walls to shut out. They're walls to include. The city of God is never an exclusive city. It doesn't belong to a happy few. It belongs to the world for whom Christ died. And so the walls have to be open, and we have to make them open, you know? And Jesus says, you know, many places, you know, narrow is the gate. It's not going to be easy, but that's not ours to say. That's something that will happen to people. But Williams wants to be very sure that we don't put up the barriers. The barriers are put up by the person himself.
Can you see him again, Mary? Can you?
Oh, yeah. The communion of saints and the forgiveness of sins, resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. Remember? The last part of the creed? Not that hard. Just remember that's where the city of God is built. Because it's built, you know, how does the last part of the creed begin? I believe, no, the last part. The Father Almighty is the first one, then Jesus Christ, and the third one, the Holy Church, the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, resurrection of the body, the life everlasting. And that's the community. You see, that's what comes out of the first part of the creed, is the city of God. This is where we live. And it's kind of a good way to think of it. Anything that wakes you up in the creed is a good thing. It's just like the Lord's Prayer. You know, Williams said that, I think I mentioned this last fall. I'm not sure if I did, but I it won't hurt to mention it again. He said once in the, I think it's in his book on the Incarnation, he came down from heaven. He says God is, for the Jews, was never in any place. God was never in any place. He couldn't be put in a place. And every place, every bit of creation, the universe, all related back to God wherever he was. But he was not settled. And so when we say our Father who art in heaven, we right away seem to place him someplace, as if heaven were a physical place. And William says, you know, it might be a very good idea once in a while if we said, our Father in whom is heaven? Our Father in whom is heaven? And that when we did that, we would realize that heaven is where God is. And I know one of my pet peeves has always been, for myself as well as for others, has been, you know, how do you think you're going to enjoy heaven, so-called, if you don't enjoy God now? I mean, it's going to be a classic bore to spend eternity with someone that you weren't interested in on this earth. You know, if the hints you've got about it don't really send you, what makes you think eternity is going to be any better? It's endless. There isn't even death to cut it off.
That reminds me of that old jingle in Bedazzle. He's in the van.
That's right, he's not anywhere. You can't put him down. That's right. It's like, I'd forgotten about that. Well, Williams would have gone along with that. Let's see. I wanted to take enough time, we've got about 15 minutes, I think, for you to, if you feel up to it, I know a lot of you have colds and it isn't easy to clear your minds, but if you can think of some things from the books that you did read of William. Some of you had a tutorial on him and read, each read a novel, and Chris mentioned the from All Hallows Eve, some of the things that came out there. What are some of the other books that you've read, the novels, or started or gotten into to some extent? Descent into Hell? Who did that? Did you read that? Well, quite a few of you read that. That's good. What, how did you understand that? Or didn't you?
That's right.
Well, what do you remember about it specifically? I mean, what are some of the things that were difficult, but also some of the things that you can remember from it that you maybe would like to ask about? Anybody?
The exchange in it.
Yeah.
The first place.
Which one?
Well, the one with Stanhope.
Stanhope?
In the Purgatory, old Carr and King, we had a session just on Charles Williams. No, after that, I suppose I kind of halfway understood it then, but it still seems really hocus-pocus sort of thing.
It really?
I have a hard time with it.
I think we all do. Really a tough thing. How many, did anybody else, what do some of the others of you think about? In the Descent into Hell, Peter Stanhope, who is the director of the play that Pauline Anstruthers is a member of, she's a member of the cast, and he says, when he sees that she's visibly troubled by something, he talks to her, and when he finds out what it is, he says he will help her. The problem that's involved is that since she's been a child, she has been haunted by what is known psychologically as a doppelganger. That is, that when she walks out, she sees herself coming to meet her. Now that's a very frightening kind of mental experience to have to live with. And she was so frightened by it that she hardly dared to go out. And she was afraid every time she'd go out that she'd see herself coming over the hill or around the corner. How did she know? She'd hear somebody walking and she might hope that it would be a teacher or maybe a postman, but it might turn out to be herself. And she was horror-struck by the possibility that she might actually, what would happen if she ever met herself? And it's not an allegorical thing. I mean, it's not that, not coming to an understanding of yourself, you know, this identity crisis. It's a real thing. an actual situation. And so she, as a result, she gradually stays inside a great deal in order to protect herself from this, and worries, always worries about going on errands and things. She doesn't always meet herself. That's the thing. She can't be sure. Isn't that right? It's a
yeah.
ambivalent thing. And he, what? What?
Karen Venus used that novel, Karen and Sonia.
That's what John said.
Yeah, and so
he said that that's why. That's why. He said he understood it, but he said he felt it was still sort of hocus pocusy from the, and I was just explaining it. Some, you weren't all, were they all
yeah.
in the prayer tutorial?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, you did it on the...
She did one for
the mm-hmm.
But in that one, it was specifically on that.
But that was specifically on this, you know, on this problem of then Peter Stanhope, remember, says, I'll take this fear from you, and whenever you, when you're frightened by this, call me up at night or day, and I'll take it from you. And I'll take it for you. And when he did take it, when he said he would take it, it wasn't a light thing. It wasn't that he was nothing for me. I'll think about it for you. It was a really entering into her kind of suffering with this. You see, that's where it loses its hocus pocusness, is the fact that it's not a casual exchange, but it's a real sense in which you take the real fright. You enter into that kind of fright imaginatively. You understand it and pray about it, so that it is not just something you can do like, you know, flipping over the pages of a prayer book. But it's a real entering into a... Mm-hmm.
You know, still, how is it then possible that she no longer has it? Still, so what bothers me.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see, you know, that. And I understood that it was
mm-hmm.
not a casual thing.
No,
that
no.
William does make a point that it's not important how long he thinks about it or that
no.
he experiences it with the same intensity that she does.
Yeah, yeah.
But nevertheless, that it is effective and... Also, I think that it can be done forward in time and back in time.
Yeah,
alone.
Yeah.
It doesn't make it any easier, but
no.
I can't see why she would not still be just as horror-stricken. I don't see how it's effective.
No, and ordinarily, you see... Yeah?
For me, the intent is to stay in shame until a god came down and gave up his immortality.
Yeah.
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 Is that related to the...
Well, in a sense, it is. It's sort of like, it actually sort of like the incarnation. You know, it's the idea that it's coming, God coming from the outside. And in a way, this is what all the symbolic, you know, all the counterpart exchanges, like with Stanhope coming from the outside to somebody who's in the chains of her own emotional disturbance. But you see, what was causing most of her problem was her fear of it. And that's what he said he would take. And he said, if you, when you are really attacked by this, call me up. And he knew that by her calling him up, that the very fact that she could talk to him and be assured that he was indeed with her in spirit on this, that the fear of it would be mitigated, because if you've got somebody to share your fear, even an ordinary fear, is lessened. So even from that point of view, at a lower level, it was true. But he also wanted her to know that he was really ready to be with her, to be helping her all the time. And it wasn't something that, well, I'll pray for you a morning, noon, and night. But that he was going to be available to her any time of the 24 hours. And in that trust that somebody cared that much for her, the loosening of the bonds also began to free. She didn't know she was being freed of them, but she was. And the thing is that what happens in all of Williams' novels is that people who have been freed or helped out of a very bad situation of being weak and ill emotionally or physically, they are at once called upon to do something for somebody else. They are immediately strengthened for the battle for something else, and this is what she does then. Remember, she has to run through this terrible area and save her ancestor. Yeah. You have to remember this is a novel. It isn't a documentary. But it does, by means of images, the very fact that you take it seriously, you see, makes it, and I did too. I mean, it really gets to you. Because it happens to you. As Lewis says, I think I quoted him the other day on that the reason for reading novels, if you have to have a reason, is if you don't study human beings, you know them. And Williams' novels are happening to you. They happen to you if you get into them. And I don't think that it's clear. I don't think that it's spelled out what actually happens. But that it happens, I know. I mean, I know that this can happen. Now, whether it can, I've never known anybody in that particular.
Well, yeah, that helps. I mean, it helps somewhat, you know, the idea of knowing someone's caring, that someone's available,
yeah,
and all that. Yeah, that would definitely lessen it. But especially the image used of carrying a package for someone,
yeah,
as though, it, you know, it can be as straightforward as that.
Yeah.
That's the sense. You know, that's the image that bothered me.
Yeah.
Then it seemed that it was not necessarily physically available,
mm-hmm,
or anything like that, but simply that an agreement you made.
Yeah.
You
know, well, that I was opposed to the idea of carrying a package. I said, when I talked about it before, I said that you talk about carrying a burden or a package. That's it's not that easy. It's not like carrying somebody's groceries.
Well, yeah, he said, you know, it's not like packaging system to be easy,
no,
to do,
no,
but that in the simplicity of it.
Yeah,
that
right. But you have to be willing to accept, I'll take it for you for a while. Yeah, that's right.
And that's still the part to me.
Yeah.
Seems,
I think that is
hard. I don't
hard.
Understand the basis for it, like a scriptural basis.
No, I think that's very hard. Except that bear you one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ.
I know.
You see, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. You know, if you don't have a burden to carry, I mean, if the Lord really has lifted you so that you can walk free, then you can actually enter into somebody else's burden. Problem I had is I have a hard time really entering into somebody else's burden. I can sound convincing to myself and to them. But here again, I feel like that the vocabulary of the faith is being used, and I don't know whether I'm there or not. It's an honest statement. I'm just simply telling you the truth. You know, I just don't believe in playing games with you and making you think that I'm different.
If you knew that, you'd be terrible.
Perhaps not. Perhaps that's true.
Yeah, part of it.
Perhaps that's part of it.
History.
Yeah. If we actually knew the kinds of things that we are saying in all their ramifications and truth, maybe we couldn't even stand them because they are so tremendous.
But part of that too is because I take these burdens on it. Oops. I didn't mean it like it's like Lewis is saying, you know, the joy would explode us.
Yes.
If I felt I knew that I was able to take people's burdens on, I would be.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah, right.
I would be unbearable to live with. That's what I mean.
Oh, that's true. You'd really feel like you were.
Yeah.
A sin bearer.
For me, I haven't read any particular book that, but for me, a lot of that relates congruent to people meeting in the conviction of sin, where someone comes broken with recognition of their sickness, if you want, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They can come to another believer, and can be really crushed on it.
Yeah.
And fearful of it. And then the other can open up that same place in himself that knows that same sin, but at that time has had fear driven out in relation to that. they can actually, put that disturbance, put that fear. You don't get rid of the sin, but they get rid of the effects of the sin in a place and the other.
Yeah.
And that there is a carrying, and that's just a common medium, in two confessional people, confessional people meeting. There's a kind of exchange that happens all the time.
Yeah.
The person is left with a difficulty, but the fear is taken away, and so they can maybe understand it.
Well, I thought I'd read this part where Stanhope talks about this. And for those of you who have read it, and you can just be reminded of it, he said, she says, "How can I cease to be troubled? Will it leave off coming because I pretend it wants you? Is it your resemblance that hurries up the street? It is not," he said, "and you shall not pretend at all. The thing itself, you may one day meet. Never mind that now. But you'll be free from all distress because that you can pass on to me. Haven't you heard it said that we ought to bear one another's burdens?" "But that means," she began and stopped. "I know," Stanhope said, "it means listening sympathetically and thinking unselfishly and being anxious about and so on. You know, that's what we're all good at." "Well, I don't say a word against all that. No doubt it helps. But I think when Christ or St. Paul or whoever said bear or whatever he Aramaically said instead of bear, he meant something much more, like carrying a parcel instead of someone else. And I think when he uses that carrying a parcel, he just wants to be sure that you understand the word bear. That bearing something is actually carrying something. See, it's an explanation of the word bear, not that it's a simple thing like just picking up a bag. To bear a burden is precisely to carry it instead of. If you're still carrying yours, I'm not carrying it for you, however sympathetic I may be. And anyhow, there's no need to introduce Christ unless you wish it. It's a fact of experience. If you give a weight to me, you can't be carrying it yourself. All I'm asking you to do is to notice that blazing truth. It doesn't sound very difficult. And if I could," she said, "if I could do whatever it is you mean, would I? Would I push my burden onto anybody else?" "Not if you insist on making a universe for yourself," he answered. "If you want to disobey and refuse the laws that are common to us all, if you want to live in pride and division and anger, you can. But if you will be part of the best of us and live and laugh and be ashamed with us, then you must be content to be helped." And this, you see, is the whole image of the city again. You must be content to be helped. You must give your burden up to someone else, and you must carry someone else's burden. "I haven't made the universe, it isn't my fault, but I'm sure that this is a law of the universe, and not to give up your parcel is as much to rebel as not to carry another's. You'll find it quite easy if you let yourself do it." "What of my self-respect?" she said. He laughed at her with a tender mockery. "Oh, if we are that kind," he exclaimed, "you want to respect yourself. If to respect yourself, you must go clean against the nature of things. If you must refuse the omnipotence in order to respect yourself, though why you should want so extremely to respect yourself is more than I can guess. But go on and respect. Must I apologize for suggesting anything else?" He mocked her and was silent, and for a while she stared back. He held her. Presently he held her at command. A long silence had gone by before he spoke again. "When you are alone," he said, "remember that I am afraid instead of you, and that I have taken over every kind of worry. Think merely that. Say to yourself, he is being worried.